and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Possessor, the second feature of Brandon Cronenberg, who, as if anyone else was named Cronenberg.
Yeah, not a lot of Cronenbergs floating around out there.
Is in fact the son of David Cronenberg, director of every body horror movie that comes to mind, first, second, third, and probably fourth in your mind. The basic premise of the film is that a sort of assassin, I guess you would call her, named Tasia Voss, a very Cronenberg-y name, if I do say so myself.
Yeah, very Cronenberg-y, very neuromancer also. There's a lot of cyberpunk mixed up in this movie, which will become very apparent as we get into our rundown here.
Yeah. So Tasia Voss, played by Andrea Riseborough, body jacks various people. I mean, really only two over the course of what actually happens in the movie, although we get the impression she has done this many times. She body jacks people and then commits murders, conducts assassinations
that are meant to look like this person just snapped.
Or happens to kill
someone of note.
Yes.
We see in the latter case, there's, you know, as you said, my co-host said, there's two hits in the movie. One just by way of prologue, and then the second takes up the bulk of the runtime. And in at least one of the cases, we see some flimsy pretext provided as to a motive. But it seems like these people are just going nuts one day. It's a spooky premise because people do just go off the deep end. Sometimes there's writing on the wall, red flags and so on. Sometimes there isn't. And it seems like the kind of thing you could see on the news. This movie is good at tapping into that kind of paranoid Cronenberg-y sort of feeling.
Yeah, that's more or less it. So the movie opens with this young woman messing with her hair, feeling along a braid in her hair, and eventually she sticks this metal probe.
Yeah, some kind of cranial implement.
Into it, and she's adjusting a dial on this device sitting on her bathroom counter, and it seems to be cycling her through different facial expressions and indeed different emotions.
Whereas I felt only one emotion. Distress and discomfort.
Burgeoning and ever-growing distress.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, ratcheting at great speed back and forth between laughter and weeping and so forth. Shortly thereafter, this woman is walking through some kind of hotel, I guess it kind of looks like.
Some kind of swanky soiree, you know, either the lobby of a hotel or some gala something or other. Looks like a posh event.
And she seems a little bit out of sorts, to say the least. And she eventually just comes up to this guy, some rich-looking dude, and stabs him many times to death.
Yeah, she shanks him in the jugular.
And then, like, more than a dozen times in the chest and abdomen while he's on the ground.
Yeah, and then proceeds to play around with his blood a little bit, as we're going to learn shortly, presumably to sell the "this woman is a nutcase" narrative.
Right. So she pulls a gun out of her purse and says out loud, as far as we can tell, to no one in particular, yeah, pull me out. Puts the gun in her mouth and attempts to pull the trigger and apparently can't bring herself to do it. The cops show up and she pulls up the gun and they shoot her.
Commits suicide by cop.
Yes.
Amounts to the same thing. Tasia, our protagonist, then reawakens on this slab. They're pulling some kind of rig, like a helmet, like a VR helmet almost, off of her face. And she's doing a little bit of diagnostic assessment type stuff afterwards with a person that I took to be her handler. You know, ask how did it go, assessing such and such, these different metrics, a bunch of made up science jargon. Basically, it went off without a hitch, as far as they're concerned.
Right. Yeah, her handler, whose name is Girdler, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
It's Jennifer Jason Leigh. She's giving Tasia this rundown, all these statistics, and then she's running through this other diagnostic where Tasia has to go through a box of various knickknacks and personal items, or perhaps not so personal items as the case may be. She pulls out this pipe and she says, "This is my grandfather's pipe. He died before I was born. My father gave it to me." She pulls out this.
She's not exactly dripping with sentimentality during any of this. She seems very alienated, even from the mementos that should mean a great deal to her.
Right. It's very much, I am reading a grocery list sort of delivery. Pulls out a butterfly, a mounted, you know, dead butterfly in a little box. Explains the story of how she killed it and mounted it when she was a child and then felt bad about it. Still feels bad about it. And then the last item she pulls out, we don't even really get a good look at exactly what it's supposed to be. Some kind of little metal knickknack. And she says just outright, "Yeah, this isn't mine." And after each of these pronouncements, Girdler says, "Yes, you know, very good." So that last one is a curveball meant to make sure she's not just coming up with false associations, I guess.
Yeah, because it does seem like she's having a hard time coming back to herself, as it were. She's done, we don't even know how many of these hits. Her grip on her identity is tenuous, it seems.
Yeah, we get more reinforcement of this idea in the following scene. After that is, she says something to Girdler about, like, "Yeah, I told Michael I was going to get some time off," to which her handler says, "Well, you and Michael are separated." Oh no, of course, but still, I told him I was going to take some time off. So the next scene, she's at the end of the block from her husband slash ex-husband's house and practicing talking to her husband and son, basically.
Yeah, as though she were gearing up for an assignment, you know, getting into character.
Right. And we also see more of that a couple scenes from now. But yeah, just like saying the same things over and over again, different deliveries, trying to get it down to a science. And then once she goes up to the door and rings it and her son comes and answers, we hear all of these things delivered in context now. So she comes inside and she has dinner with her family, then has some kind of get-together with some friends of her husband's, and then she gets him to send them home, and they have sex, which she does not seem even remotely engaged in whatsoever.
Much like everything else.
Right, very stare at the ceiling, and then eventually she seems to put forth some kind of perfunctory effort, and this is already enough to tell her, okay, I've back to the grind.
Yeah, well,
time to be hitting the old dusty trail.
Working hard or hardly working.
I don't know whether she's meant to be in an active conversation with Girdler or if she's just like leaving her a voicemail, but either way, she's saying, "I'm all good. I'm ready to come back to work. Give me a call. Let me know."
So the next assignment is a doozy. She is brain jacking the future son-in-law of some big wig.
Tech mogul,
played by Sean Bean, we soon come to find, although not soon enough. The more Sean Bean, the better.
Yes.
And things start to go awry almost immediately. She gets into this guy's head and his body and his... So first of all, you're hit with the... Even before anything starts to go seriously wrong, you're hit with the anxiety of just impersonating someone. And this doesn't need like a sci-fi conceit in order to work. A bunch of noir movies where this sort of thing happens, where you just need to nail all of your answers and have done your homework. The wife says, "Oh, you've gone strange on me. Are you okay? You're not yourself," that kind of thing. And that makes me nervous. You know, you feel like secondhand embarrassment isn't the right word, just secondhand stress, thinking, oh, sure. No, he'll be caught, she'll be caught.
Right.
So right off the bat, she is not selling the performance. She is not passing this one with flying colors. And then we start getting technical glitches of a kind. Like, what is the guy's name who she has hijacked?
Colin.
Colin goes into work in this very oppressive Amazonian, I guess, kind of environment. It's like if the NSA was an Amazon warehouse. Basically, you're in front of a computer terminal and you're hijacking people's Alexas and their, you know, other gadgets all
their
day.
Webcams and so forth.
Yeah. And looking for
window dressing.
Well, just any products, I assume. I think that he was on like drapery duty.
Well, yeah, I mean, his particular task that day, he's looking at drapes and curtains and blinds and identifying them by color and type and fabric and so forth.
Yeah, basically seeing what people are buying. And because this is actually the first time she's done this job, getting sidetracked because nude people are strutting past the camera, secure in the privacy of their own homes, or stupping each other.
Even, yeah, having sex.
And in the midst of all this, she starts seeing, it's hard to know what to make of it. It looks like a little tuft of cotton, maybe, or like a styrofoam packing peanut, like a little floating phantom swab of nothing.
Yes.
Little, just floating, like, you know, those like floaters you get in the periphery of your vision sometimes, but much more substantial looking.
Yeah.
And she will like reach out and try to grab it, and it gives her what looks to be like a static shock. And then ceases to exist. So she's losing her grip. She yanks off her headset, wanders away from her post, and has to reassert control in a stairwell. Get a grip, basically.
And it's interesting, the middle section, basically, of the movie, the first chunk of this assignment, there's a certain amount of uncertainty as to how much of the odd behavior is because this interface isn't working right, and how much of it is on purpose, because part of her directive is to make this guy seem like he's coming unglued.
Yeah, to make him behave more and more erratically, escalating to the murder.
Right. So, as you brought up, when the girlfriend says something to the effect of, "You seem strange today," it's tough to know just how much that's good news for Tasia and how much it's bad news.
It could be a blessing in disguise, you know, again, provided she gets a grip at the right junctures.
Right. Meanwhile, she has to kind of repeatedly be reassuring Girdler of her control over the situation. She has to check in periodically. Girdler is always inside his head, back at corporate, on the couch beside Tasia in her corporeal form.
And it's funny, every time they converse that way, when Colin speaks, you hear the two voices simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
The outside voice and the inside voice, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
It's a funny little aural trick to get you see the puppet and the strings at the same time. It's a, you know, simple trick, obviously, but effective.
Yes.
So we finally meet Sean Bean. He's giving a toast, as Bond villains are wont to do. And Colin, for all intents and purposes, makes a scene at this party, gets into an altercation with him, is...
After receiving explicit instructions to do so.
Right.
After Sean Bean is a complete condescending dick to him.
Yeah, he's pretending to be more inebriated than he actually is, I take it, and then gets ejected from the party forcibly after decking one of the other hotshots that Sean Bean was talking to.
Right. You'll notice we're hopping back and forth on our pronouns.
Well, yeah.
It is what it is.
There's the rub.
And while the division is clearer now in the section that we're talking about, it's going to be very muddled. That's kind of the whole conceit of the second half.
Well, yeah, and so much of it, too, you're not getting a lot of internal monologue from the assassin's perspective. You are mostly just observing Colin from the outside. So it is easy to lapse into, oh, Colin does this, Colin does that. And effectively, that is what's happening, even if he is just a meat puppet.
Right.
I mean, that's how it'll be remembered.
So,
and therein lies the horror.
Precisely. Sometime later, and it doesn't seem like Tasia / Colin has actually left the grounds, like hiding in the bushes or something for a few hours, comes back in with a gun. All the party guests have departed. It's just Sean Bean and the girlfriend, the character's name is Ava, father and daughter, at the kitchen table drinking. Like, half commiserating and half castigating one another. Clearly, her unhealthy relationship is not just with her father, is not just performative for her boyfriend's sake.
You know, and he, being Sean Bean, was disenchanted with his new son-in-law even before this latest upset. He's kind of shitty and cold to him at the party even before he comes out swinging.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of acrimony there.
So they're having this very tense, drunk conversation. And then Ava says, "Okay, I'm going to bed." And she proceeds to do so. And this is when Colin flops down in the seat that Ava has just vacated and starts being very threatening, puts the gun on the table, has also picked up, while walking through other rooms in the house, a fireplace poker, crucially. They have some very...
pissing match kind of banter.
Yeah, ominous banter back and forth. And then this ends with Sean Bean basically saying, I'm drunk, I'm going to bed, don't make me call the cops. Yeah.
All of their previous acrimony goes a long way towards explaining why Sean Bean doesn't take this threat seriously. Right. He thinks he's still dealing with Colin.
At which time the poker comes out and Colin just starts...
Does it ever.
Wailing on Sean Bean. This is where the body horror gene comes in.
Yeah, and it's not a ruthless, or rather it is ruthless. It's not an efficient John Wick style assassination.
It's not a cold-blooded in the sense of efficient. Yeah,
because it's supposed to look like a professional hit. I mean, he is hitting him in the shoulders, hitting him in the chest, hitting him in the head, you know, with intent to kill, but also hitting him non-fatally all over the place, and it's brutal.
Yeah,
and prolonged.
But the body horror really comes in when Colin / Tasia jabs the poker into the would-be father-in-law's mouth and just is basically twisting it around, jerking it back and
knocking
forth.
Knocking loose teeth and trying to pry his face apart, effectively.
Ava comes back into the room at this point. Colin pops off a few rounds. It looked at first like he missed and was not showing a lot of urgency in chasing her down, as we are shortly to discover she actually was hit and collapses a couple rooms away before getting the kill shot to the back of the head. Once again, we get to the gun in mouth, pull me out point.
And once again, there's a moment of hesitation,
which stretches out to several moments, which becomes...
the rest of the movie.
The rest of the movie. So Colin, seeming to reassert control, jabs the poker into the crown of his own head where the implant is. It basically disrupts the connection.
Yeah, the circuitry or who knows what.
This induces internal bleeding, cranial bleeding on...
Yeah, I mean,
Tasia's
he's got to get through a lot of his own equipment before he gets to...
Well, no, but I mean Tasia also.
Oh, yes. On the slab with the fucking the Strange Days headset on. Yes, she also starts like coughing up blood.
Coughs up a lot of blood. Girdler doesn't want to pull her out because the job's not necessarily finished the way they want it. And also there's some question, you leave her in there in this state, maybe she can have brain damage, but maybe there'll also be damage depending on how you pull her out. It's a very fraught procedure, presumably.
But we get the sense that character Girdler is cold-blooded enough that we get the sense that her primary motivation is to
get the job done.
Eliminate the loose end. Yeah.
Right. But anyway, again, it seems as though Colin has kind of gotten control and he flees the scene, flees through some city streets, and eventually ends up at the apartment of one of Ava's friends who he apparently has had a side thing with. Possibly with Ava's knowledge. There's some indication of that earlier on. But in any case, kind of wheedles his way inside, and as she is about to go out of town, secures her permission to stay in the place a couple days. You know, Ava and I had a fight. I can't go home. But boy, did they.
Yeah.
So as this is going on, Tasia is struggling to reassert control because for the last number of hours, she's just been kind of stuck along for the ride. Eventually, she does, it seems. I mean, from this point on in the synopsis, a lot of this is going to be best guess and conjecture just because the film is deliberately unclear as to who is doing what and who is responsible for what.
Every once in a while, there is an insert shot of Tasia standing there where Colin had just been a moment before.
Wearing his clothes.
And yeah, frankly, I could have done without those inserts. I prefer to just look at Colin from the outside and make my inferences, but that is what we get the vast majority of the time.
Right.
So Colin, whoever's agency is piloting him, goes into the bathroom where the woman is showering and he murders her, shoots her.
Yeah. And then proceeds to go into a fugue state. Basically just
it's
has
a phrase we bandy about a lot on the Shock Doctors podcast.
Well,
but
just
that's
the last couple episodes.
The kind of movies we cover.
Last couple
these
episodes
are not
in particular.
These people are not well.
But just eventually blacks out, and then hears a pounding on the front door, and it's his very sleazeball friend, Eddie, who we met earlier.
Co-worker.
Right. He talks his way inside, and then as soon as Colin's back is turned, drops him with some kind of tasery sort of device, and we discover that he's a plant from the Assassin Corporation, who was sent in initially to kind of scout out Colin, and now has been tasked with
helping with cleanup.
Yeah, recalibrating the implant and helping Tasia to finish the job, essentially.
So when Colin comes to, he starts running them, her, Tasia, through a version of what we got before with the butterfly and the other mementos. What kind of animal is this on a little iPad or something?
Is it this or this?
Yeah.
And apparently Tasia gets all the answers right, so that's good. And then he has to run some kind of, I think he calls it a pulse test.
Uh-huh.
And this does not end up going well. Woof. This is probably the most unsettling part of the film, I would think. Although the climax is also pretty balls to the wall.
Yeah, that wins for me, although.
But that's...
I'll let you wax rhapsodic about this vignette also.
Well, yeah, it's... The climax is more just in the depth of the carnage, but in terms of just fucking being whacked out as all hell, this is where it...
Oh, I get you. Yeah.
Yeah. So, first, it's just, we get, again, these blink in and out insert shots of Tasia laying on the bed in Colin's place, always in a red lit version of the room.
Aggressively, yeah, neon red.
But eventually, these shots start including a Colin standing in the background and approaching. Eventually, he climbs up on top of Tasia, obviously, again, intercut with him laying on the bed in quote-unquote real life, and starts choking her, which is interesting because one of the things that Eddie said prior to the start of this test is just remember to breathe.
Yeah.
So
Colin was listening.
Starts choking her and then reaches up to squeeze her skull, which just cracks like an egg. Like I was expecting something gooshier, but instead it just, it's like an empty egg. It's like an egg shell with nothing inside. It just,
which is trenchant because she is something of a vacuity as a character. She's been hollowed out by all of these hijackings that she's had to perform. There's not much in there anymore.
Right. And obviously, you know, she's also hollowing out people when she goes inside them and works on multiple levels. And then Colin grabs the rubbery remains of her face and puts it on his face like a mask. This is the image you'll see on most of the posters for Possessor.
It's a haunting image. It's a good mask. You could have built a pretty good slasher movie just around that mask.
It's a fucked up mask.
And as far as slasher villain masks go, it's got a little bit, it's too loose to be uncanny in the true sense, but it reminded me of the mask from The Rental, which we praised several episodes back.
Yeah, for sure.
But the bagginess of it is also kind of horrifying. The fact that it's a bad fit makes thematic sense and also, I don't know, just makes her, him, them look more bedraggled and kind of witchy and hard to look at.
Yeah. So we blink through a series of, I guess, replays of prior scenes.
Most disturbing of which is Tasia having joyless sex with her ex-husband, but with the mask on.
And it's also Colin.
Colin, yeah.
In the mask underneath Tasia's husband. And, you know, standing out on their block, being the young woman at the beginning of the movie.
Right.
But again, it's just Colin wearing that woman's clothes and then the mask. It's again.
Layers, man.
It's wild. But eventually, this ends with Colin waking up in his own body. He has, without being conscious, killed Eddie. He goes into the bathroom, and this is when he discovers that he has killed the girlfriend's friend. When we mentioned it initially, it cuts away from him, like, holding a gun up. We don't actually see the murder take place at that time. It's just assumed, and then now we see the body.
And the murder itself in fragments.
In some least. Fragments, yeah. So from there, Colin takes it upon himself to go visit Tasia's family to, I think, try to provoke her into coming out in his mind to talk to him.
Uh-huh.
Kind of wheedles and then eventually forces his way into the house, takes Michael, Tasia's husband, hostage at his own kitchen table.
Issues a tidy little monologue about kitty litter and brain parasites that live therein.
The worm. Are you married to her or to the worm? Yeah, it's pretty good stuff. And then he slips into a fugue state where he is talking to Tasia, again, wearing the same clothes as he is. And again, there's a lot of that double-layered voice stuff going on kind of throughout this back and forth. He's saying, like, look what you made me do. How are you doing this? Get out of my head. And she's saying, yeah, but did I do that? Or did you?
She basically brain fucks him. She does what he was trying to just do to Michael, but much more adeptly.
Because she's the professional.
Right, exactly.
So it makes sense.
Because when he delivers that whole monologue about kitty litter, his delivery, I think to the movie's credit, this is intentional when it's juxtaposed with Tasia doing a version of the same thing moments afterward. His speech is a little bit try hard. You know, he's like, fuck you, man. He's, you know, hands shaking on the gun and all of that, you know.
Right.
Are you married to the worm? Or, and then when Tasia does it, she's just cool as a cucumber.
Right.
It's chilling.
Who did this? Was it me or you? This is my grandfather's pipe. it's the same cadence. I still feel bad about mounting this butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
In the course of this fugue state, Michael gets the bright idea to try and get the drop on Colin, knocks the gun away, and gets to it, tries to shoot Colin, but only wings him, and Colin gets a hold of a cleaver, first chops off half of Michael's hand, and then just goes to town. When Michael and Tasha's kid comes in and stabs Colin in the neck.
Yeah, we don't know who the assailant is at first, and the hand wielding the knife does not look conspicuously small. Then again, it happens so quickly.
Yeah.
And then you look, and it's like, oh my God, everyone, the whole family's in on it. Everyone's getting in on the bloodbath. And then Colin shoots the kid in the gut.
Yeah, and we get, again, a cross-cut of an insert shot of Tasia doing the shooting. And, oh.
Having, yeah, just murdered her own son.
Right. And then they're both laying on the ground, Colin and the child. Their blood is pooling together. And then the child says, pull me out. At which time we wake up back in the operations center, so to speak. And Tasia and Girdler are on, you know, matching slabs, both under together. So Girdler had been implanted in the kid's head to finally tie the job up in a neat bow. And then we have a scene of Girdler doing the run-through with Tasia again. This is my grandfather's pipe. I mounted this butterfly. Cut to black.
Yeah.
So that was Possessor. We're going to go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with some more thoughts afterwards.
You have a very special nature. One we've worked hard together to unlock.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
I need to know. I need to know what she's done to me.
She's become a danger.
Where is she? Come out or I'll do it!
Sometimes that small thought is all it takes to lose control.
And we are back. So, Matt, how about you take it away?
We talked about the dial in the opening scene that cycles through the various emotional states and facial expressions and so on. There were sequences in this movie that made me feel like Brandon Cronenberg had his finger on a dial that he was just twisting inexorably higher and making me squirm in my seat. The apple did not fall far from the tree in that respect. I think he is definitely his father's son, and he's not trying to hide that fact. You know, he's embraced the body horror school, but it's more the Cronenberg, I think, of, say, Eastern Promises, where you get like the bathhouse brawl in Eastern Promises, where it's just like, feast your eyes on what men can do to each other when it's you or the other guy. And it's just awkward and clumsy and bone crunching, gnarly, visceral body horror action. I mean, the climax reminded me of Taxi Driver, especially the ending of Taxi Driver. I mean, especially when the guy gets half his hand, in this case, cleaved off, and Taxi Driver, he gets half his hand shot off. In both cases, they lose, this has always struck me, you know, watching that movie and now this movie, they lose an awkward amount of hand. It's like a messy, untidy, accidental looking amount of hand. It's not like a clean cut by any means. You know, it looks like crime scene photographs. It looks like a crime of passion. And that jumped out at me. I really go in for that sort of thing. If you really want to make the audience feel sick to their stomach, that's one way to do it. Just give me, just put the cuts in different places. Have not just like a, not, they don't lose a finger, they lose two fingers and then one third of their middle finger, you know, just something like that. Or they get, or like when
they lose
when
an odd 30% of their palm,
right? Or when he's whacking Sean Bean with the fireplace poker, he doesn't just go for the head and cave it in. And I like Drive a whole lot, the like elevator beat down, but even that is cleaner than what I'm describing, because he's just relentlessly stomping the face
right
over and over. And that is stomach churning, but it's also methodical and precise, whereas here it looks like you're watching two people just go apeshit on each other. Well, actually, one person go apeshit on another person who is totally defenseless, at least in that case, the case of Sean Bean's demise.
Right.
But the whole movie is full of violence like that, and I think that's where the horror originates for me. And then you get the conceptual horror of all the sci-fi framework in which all of this is happening. Is it you? Is it me? Is it the worm? And so on.
Right. Yeah, as I said, the kind of uncanny valley, weird to look at, just unsettling.
It's hag-like is what it is. I mean, it looks a little bit like, you know, Leatherface, particularly Leatherface when he's in more of a drag mode, which happens periodically in that movie.
Yeah.
And in its sequels, or the woman who gets Leatherfaced against her will in Devil's Rejects. Which is probably the only scene in that movie that really kind of gets under my skin a little bit. We're not Rob Zombie stands, as you likely know, if you've been listening for a while. But that scene I do rather like, which is to say that I dislike it strongly, but but in a way that I kind of begrudgingly admire.
Appreciate, yeah. As I said during the synopsis, that part is what I think most got under my skin in a sort of horror movie sense.
Yeah.
I agree with you that the climax, obviously, on its face, and it's not just that you brought it up and I'm like, oh yeah.
No, I know.
it's fucked up that he goes and butchers this guy and then she shoots the kid after the kid fucking stabs him. I mean, that's fucking hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you could find that in, like, revenge thriller exploitation type movie that's not necessarily unique to the genre.
Yeah, I mean, Taxi Driver is not a horror movie, nor is Eastern Promises.
Right. And then there's just the horror, like we touched on briefly during the synopsis, of just social disconnect going into that, like Matt said, Amazon NSA warehouse, just slipping on. Again, this is another scenario in addition to the assassins, where somebody is basically putting on a VR headset to, in this case, spy on people and their drapes.
Yeah, well, it's an invasion that is less profound than literally getting inside someone's skull and their skin, but it's sort of the next best thing, next worst thing.
Right, and in this case, with the assassins thing, it's like, we don't know how many people are actually doing this. It might just be a handful of people.
Mm-hmm.
In the tech building, it's a human factory.
It's mass surveillance. Yeah. When the coworkers meet up in the bathroom, he says, hey, I saw you ran out of the mines. They've got very, like, Amazon worker, that kind of mentality about it. Here's a phrase that's in vogue: boring dystopia. This is something you see on social media a lot these days. We live in a boring dystopia. You know, it's not exciting, it's not Orwellian, it's just bland and kind of soul crushing in a blasé, ho-hum, what are you gonna do kind of way. This movie is really on board with that.
Right. And then living day to day in a boring dystopia is, as the name would suggest, pretty boring. But when you've got that kind of messaging running through a movie that also has much more overt dystopia, it kind of elevates the boring part into something that is nearly as unsettling at the same time.
Our particular dystopia has been markedly less boring of late. We're recording this on January 6th. Just let the records show.
Sure.
Less said about that, the better.
Readily granted. But yeah, whereas day to day we could say, oh man, fucking Alexa's listening to us all the time, I'll bet.
Yeah. Lol, we were just talking about this, and now I got an ad on Twitter, a targeted ad that happens to be about this thing we were just discussing. Is it a creepy coincidence, or, you know?
And then you take that and you put it in this movie where people are being brain-jacked, but also, oh yeah, people are watching me fuck through my webcam to determine what kind of blinds I have.
It's not that comforting to know that they're supposed to only be focusing on the drapes.
No. It's not at all comforting.
No consolation whatsoever.
Oh.
And the technology in this movie is mostly very analog, kind of retro looking, but not in a precious, like, retro futurist sort of way. It reminded me, and I name dropped this movie at one point during the plot rundown, it reminded me of Strange Days, mm-hmm. the Catherine Bigelow movie, where it still looks like you're dealing with VHS technology.
Yeah.
The rig that the assassin straps into is kind of bulky and minimalist. It's a little sleek, but it doesn't look state-of-the-art, put it that way. It looks like it could accidentally teleport you to the far side of Jupiter or into a potato or something. It looks like glitches are... Like, when the glitches start happening, you figure, well, yeah, that tracks.
Well, it looks like something you can find in your doctor's office.
Right.
That's what it is. I was about to say optometrist, but it's not like one of those... Whatever the thing with all the lenses in it is called. It doesn't look like that.
Mm-hmm.
It looks kind of like a, I don't know, a microscope almost. But yeah, again, like something you could find in your doctor's office. And you don't have to have a cool doctor. This could be your, like, 65-year-old general practitioner with all of his equipment that he's owned since he opened his practice 25 years ago. That kind of thing.
Yeah, and movies can go two different ways with this sort of thing. You look at a movie like The Cell, which is goofy as all get out, but which I yes. mostly like. And it's about a similar procedure. When J-Lo goes inside Vincent D'Onofrio's brain in that movie, the suit that she has to don is this skin-tight, red, musculature-looking thing. Looks like a bunch of exposed muscle, like a skinless human suit. And that's very theatrical, very eye-catching. This movie goes basically as far in the other direction as you possibly can go.
Right.
And that pays off dividends, I think, because it makes everything feel very unglamorous, very boring. And so much of the baseline tension is established with the kind of impersonation stress that I was talking about partway through the plot synopsis, even before the bloodletting begins in earnest, prologue notwithstanding, obviously, when Colin, quote unquote, is just trying to hit his marks and blend in and play the role that's been assigned to him. My favorite line, I already talked about, oh, you're not yourself today, you've gone strange on me, and so on. My favorite line in that vein is in a scene that we didn't touch on really, or at least didn't linger on, where he and his girlfriend are entertaining friends,
right.
And they're snorting coke off of a framed picture, a couple's selfie of him and his girlfriend. Ava, is that right?
Yeah.
Ava. Right. This is during the fucking prelude to the body jacking. This is something that she has to correct herself on. Make sure you get the pronunciation right. I have the luxury of not caring all that much. But anyway.
You don't have to murder her later.
There's a lot of peril baked into this sequence. It's happening in a couple different places at once. It's a little bit of a juggling act because conversationally, there's landmines that have to be avoided. Colin acts like he's never met this particular friend before, and she goes, oh, we've met. I guess I wasn't very memorable. Laughs it off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so he gets like a look like, oh, crisis averted. And you feel this little twinge of like, oh, he almost got him. You know, that could have been bad. And meanwhile, he's snorting coke. Who knows how that might interfere with the neural networking that's going on here.
Right.
So that's a potential hiccup. And then he's looking at his face in the photograph that he's snorting lines off of. And he says, who's that?
Who is this? And Ava was just like, what?
So it's just one little upset after another. And I've said this before, I don't remember which review it was, that tension doesn't dissipate. It just dovetails nicely into the action horror tension of the violent set pieces that follow it. But the tension is ratcheting up continuously throughout the movie. It is one arc. It just transitions from these kind of faux pas to an abattoir.
Right.
But the trajectory is sort of all of a piece with itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Obviously, we talked at length during the synopsis about the fact that there's perpetual uncertainty as to who is who and who's controlling Colin at any given time through basically the entire second half of the film. Another of the smaller ways that this is driven home is earlier on, first, Tasia is practicing her own dialogue, so to speak, and then there's a scene that we may have briefly touched on or may have just elided where she's spying on the couple through their window, repeating after him to try and get his rhythms of speech and cadences right. And then later on, Colin is repeating under his breath some of the things that Tasia was saying outside on her block as she's approaching her ex's house. And this is happening during stretches where, at least as far as we can tell, Colin has reasserted control of himself. But even then, she's kind of bleeding into him. And there are these sort of flashy, intercut body horror sequences, most especially during the stretch where he stabs himself in the head to bust up the implant. But I think they crop up later. Maybe they don't. Either way, their faces have, like, kind of fused together and broken off in weird places, putty. And so, again, it's not just one thing or two things. It's everything that is suggesting to one degree or another where we can never be certain who's in control and to what degree someone has become someone else and vice versa. And I think that's to the movie's benefit.
There are just moments, body language moments, where the first one that struck me is when Colin is at the party right before he picks a fight with Sean Bean. Not the fight that leads to Sean Bean's death, the one that gets him thrown out earlier in the evening. He's just standing weird, and it's because I think Tasia is play-acting drunkenness. But given what we know about what's going on, it just makes him look like he's uncomfortable in his own skin. I mean, his posture, it doesn't look like a guy who's tipsy or trashed even. He's just standing like he's in a high wind, almost his head's kind of lolling. He's just tilting in one direction. And it's maybe not as over the top as I'm making it sound. The camera is also kind of tilted at him at a slightly queasy sort of vertiginous angle that makes it look like he's about to topple over when in fact it might just be a matter of degrees. You know, he's just a little bit off in a way that would immediately strike me as off-putting if I were to see someone doing that, you know, out and about.
He looks just a little bit like a slack marionette.
Right.
Like,
with one of the strings cut.
Yeah, not full-on Ultron, there are no strings on me, you know, or fucking gamer or whatever, doing weird poses.
Oh, gamer, fuck yeah.
But just...
No discussion of cyberpunk cinema would be complete without a gamer nod.
But yeah, like 5% of that. Yes. That's what this is.
Again, we got our finger on the dial. We're calibrating it just so. And then the other incident, body language moment that jumped out at me, the dial gets cranked up a good deal further. It's when he's obliterating Sean Bean's face. There's a close-up of Colin's face. And as he's doing God knows what to Sean Bean's mouth, he tilts his head to the side in that sort of, it's like a Michael Myers head tilt, almost, mm-hmm. that inquisitive bird kind of movement. But the way, as he cranes his neck, you hear this awful crunchy, like, of terrible things being done to Sean Bean's
face,
mouth parts. And so the collision of sight and sound indicate it's like his skin is too tight, Colin's skin. I mean, the sound accompanied with that head tilt makes it sound like, I don't know, like a big praying mantis is about to rip out of him or something. Like he's harboring some kind of hibernating beast. His flesh chrysalis is about to slough off or something. I mean, that gets to the heart of body horror in a kind of more literal, cheesy 80s way than this movie ever really goes for. But it's kind of hinted at in moments like that where Colin looks like the host of some parasitic organism.
Right.
You know, and that's just accomplished through the soundtrack more than anything, as much as the body language, I should say. And he invokes this idea of parasitism explicitly when he goes on the monologue about the cat turds. Yeah.
The three primary performances, well, four. We'll throw in Sean Bean. What the hell?
Sure.
Always a good time. But the
it's funny, when he showed up on screen, my co-host blurted out, well, now we know that the hit's going to be a success.
You know, he has to die.
Sean Bean never makes it to the credits alive and intact.
So, yeah, the four central performances, they're all very good. Andrea Riseborough absolutely nails, as I think we've already said, the sort of just completely disassociated, disconnected, almost completely devoid of personality person that she is.
Yeah, she's got this sickly pallor, and she's just very scrawny and angular. She's got a little bit of a Tilda Swinton thing going on in this movie, but even more kind of emaciated and unwell looking.
Right.
I'm not saying that Tilda Swinton is emaciated or unwell. I mean, in this movie, the way that she's lit and the way that she behaves, her tics, she's got that kind of fearsome quality that Tilda Swinton has, coupled with this sort of pallid complexion, and she just looks like she's not all there.
Yeah,
not right in the head.
Christopher Abbott, who plays Colin, Matt and I saw him a couple years ago in a movie called Piercing, which was pretty good. I wouldn't say it was great, but it was pretty good, and he was good in that. He's also good here. He sells all of the many notes he is required to hit.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he's conveying the, again, dissociated Tasia inside his body affect, or the tussle between the two when the stakes are heightened and they're struggling, or his own unease with the situation he's in, or outright panic after he's initially come through.
He does two things that I thought were impossible. One with aplomb, and then the other, he just barely gets away with it. I guess I'll do that one first. There's a couple scenes in this movie where he vapes, and I just can't take it seriously. He's like vaping and staring at the house that he's about to invade and commit burglary and hostage taking and murder in. He's looking at Tasia's house and just vaping up a storm. We complained about this in the review of Antebellum. I think there were unique reasons why it didn't work in that context. Here, it's more contextually appropriate. Again, boring dystopia. It does kind of look like a little cyberpunk body mod sci-fi device.
Yeah.
You know, when you stop and look at it. So it fits the milieu. But anyway, that didn't make me laugh out loud the way it might have in less capable hands. The thing that I really want to laud, though, is earlier in the movie, he does something that I definitely thought could not be done, which is he does a version of the I can't tell if that person is crying or laughing, or like they start laughing, then transition to crying, start crying, then transition to laughing. I thought that that was a fairly limited instrument. He does one that I had not heard before, you know, because you imagine a scene like that, it's always someone cackling and then bawling. Mm-hmm. His is very understated. The laugh is spooky. It's like it's but performed much more credibly.
Sure.
And then from that, some switch gets flipped, and instead it's more of a, like, he's choking back sobs, but he's also kind of a little bit catatonic. He's also a little bit catatonic the whole time, so it's not maudlin, you know, it's not showy. He's just a guy who's going through some stuff that's incompatible, which is fitting for the kind of role that this is, the kind of movie this is, the premise.
Yeah.
He's at war with himself.
And then Jennifer Jason Leigh is a perfect lizard person.
Right.
She's cold-blooded.
And the question lingers, and it's, I want to applaud this too. This question is not posited by the film explicitly, but the question at the end that you have to ask yourself is, how much of a hand did she have in all of this going off the rails the way that it did? Especially when you find out there was another agent in the form of the coworker kind of monitoring the whole thing. Surely he could have stepped in sooner if it was that important to them that things not go so badly foobar.
Right.
Or, you know, if she could have just jumped in at any time the way that she does at the end, surely she could have done damage control that way. So did she want Tasia to wind up killing her family to further alienate her?
Well, yeah, there, and it's not even that much of a logical leap to go there, because during her first debrief, well, it, really immediately after that, they're talking about how they're going to proceed, what they're going to do going forward. Girdler is talking about how, I don't know how much longer I can do this. I can't interface anymore, and the job I'm doing now, I don't even know how much longer I can do that. When the time comes, I want you to take over. I think you'd be great at it, but there's this tiny little string connecting you to a life that I thought you had given up. I thought you had... She's speaking of it in terms of, like, any...
work-life balance.
Well, not even that. She's talking about it in terms of any one of the multitude of body jackings.
Oh, sure.
Mind jackings that Tassia has done. It's like her being connected to her family is like her having vestigial connections to somebody she jacked into and forced to commit suicide after murdering someone. But yeah, she's saying like this vestigial connection could make you lose your grip on everything and it could ruin everything. So, yeah, once you keep that in mind from earlier on in the movie, once you get to the end of the movie, you think...
Probably not a coincidence that she winds up totally unmoored.
Yeah, I think this is exactly what Girdler wanted.
And it's great because the movie doesn't... That possibility that Girdler's the culprit either doesn't occur to Tassia, or even more ominously, perhaps, she no longer cares.
Right.
Like she's figured it, she's connected to those dots, and it just doesn't matter to her. And that's a real dystopian knockout punch. You know, that's like, he loved Big Brother. And then you close the book. They're gone. They've been indoctrinated. They're lost.
Yeah.
The protagonist that you've been hoping was going to get free of this network that they're trapped in. It's good stuff. I mean, yeah. Any movie about a boring dystopia has to eventually reveal, well, actually, once you peel back the niceties, it's not boring at all. Sorry to Bother You also does this really expertly. It's a boring dystopia until it isn't.
Until it isn't. Boy, howdy.
Yes.
Sorry to Bother You is nuts. So I think now's as good a time as any to segue into our recommendations. I am going to go, perhaps not surprisingly, with a David Cronenberg film from a little over 20 years ago now, late 90s.
I have not seen this one.
It's called Existenz. It's basically about like a VR video game designer played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, who essentially gets lost in her own video game in a sort of like loss of identity sense. And she loses a grip on what's real, who's on her side, who isn't, who she can trust, who she can't. I mean, it's basically hitting a lot of the notes that this movie is hitting. I don't want to imply that Possessor is derivative of Existenz, because it's not.
Is derivative of other things.
Also you know? True. But they treat the subjects rather differently. So it's not just a retread or anything, but there are a lot of parallels in that sense. And I was reminded of that movie, not just because of Jennifer Jason Leigh being in both, but because it involves somebody sliding into somebody else's life. In the case of Existenz, it's sliding into the life of a fictional video game character.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, in this, it's sliding into someone else's life in a physical brainjacking sense. But there are commonalities there. And yeah, Existenz is cool. I'm a big David Cronenberg fan, and I guess now also Brandon Cronenberg fan. So
yeah, we got to check out Antiviral at some point. So this loss of identity thing is all over the place in science fiction and body horror science fiction, particularly cyberpunky sort of themes. My favorite probably ever iteration of this trope is the scene in RoboCop where Murphy goes back to his house and is getting these sort of VHS staticky images of memories fading in from his POV. You know, you see through his visor.
Mm-hmm.
As he, you know, sees his wife and family in happier times, these memories that are like corroded files in his brain. That it's done in this very retro, I suppose not retro at the time, but even at the time, they weren't trying to make it look futuristic. It still looked like 80s tech, which was a conscious decision. It's very affecting. I'm not going to, you know, obviously watch RoboCop if you haven't. I love RoboCop. I'm going to formally recommend Strange Days, which I already harped on about a little bit, so I don't want to repeat myself too much. Strange Days is great. It's Kathryn Bigelow really cutting loose with a lot of long takes from POV perspectives, point of view shots that just go on and on and on. People running up and down stairs over train tracks. The one that kicks off the movie is especially glorious. It ends with the person falling to their death from a rooftop. We see this looking through their eye sockets, screaming on the way down, and then cut to Ralph Fiennes yanking off a headset going like, ah, the fuck. Having just felt like he just died, having experienced this whole heist gone wrong as though he were actually this person, and going like, you know, I don't like snuff movies. Come on, man. To the seedy dealer who was trying to pawn this tape off on him. It's a black market for mostly pornographic, but sometimes even more illicit perspective hopping. Discs, tapes, I can't remember what the technology is. It doesn't really matter. These No. programs effectively that you download into your brain and then you experience the world from someone else's point of view. And it's used in that movie for all kinds of scummy voyeuristic purposes. I like Strange Days quite a bit. I also want to recommend a movie that I'm a little more iffy on in terms of its merits or my feelings toward it overall. But I was very taken with the first, I'm going to say 20 minutes of it, the first movement of it. That movie is Upstream Color. The okay. opening of that movie, the whole movie is very slippery. It's hard to get a handle on, but it is about two people, a man and a woman, whose bodies have been hijacked, and they wake up from said hijacking with amnesia, near complete amnesia, from what I can remember in my state of semi-amnesia. They find one another through this mystic bond that they share, having both been involved in some kind of criminal plot that involved them getting brainwashed and then dumped separately. But then they sort of come together again through these quasi-mystical means. And the movie plays out like this kind of weird romance with these sci-fi trappings that are never pinned down. We get shots that are hard to come to grips with. We get the sense that there's some kind of weird life cycle at play where this parasite, this brain parasite, is bred inside of pigs. And then when the parasite comes to fruition, it's like planted in people. And then these people can be compelled to do things against their will. But there's a lot of shots of just pigs and people and nature. It's kind of like a wannabe Malick thing, too, to top it all off. Very spiritual. It's arty and messy. And on the whole, I didn't know quite what to make of it. But I really liked the opening of it when the mystery is first kind of taking shape in the viewer's mind, when you're still holding out hope that maybe some of these pieces are going to come together. Mm-hmm. And maybe on a subsequent viewing, some of them would. I don't know. I've only watched it once, but I'm still going to recommend it. It's worth seeking out. And I thought of it off and on while I was watching Possessor, which is really always the main criteria, you know, when it comes to my recommendations. You know, what else was cluttering up my brain? What analogs did I see? Did I pull out of my database? So
there you have it. Upstream Color, it's Shane Carruth, right?
Yeah.
Primer. Okay, yeah. Well,
Upstream
yeah.
Color is Primer with none of the explanatory narration or any of the expositional dialogue. Expository is the word. Any of the expository dialogue. Even in Primer, it also doesn't make a lick of sense to me, but an attempt was made. Right. In Upstream Color, they just like, dispense with the pretense of even like, trying to...
You get what you get.
Yeah.
All right, well, I haven't seen Upstream Color.
So and I haven't seen Existenz.
So I can't speak to that, but we agree on Strange Days. Strange Days is awesome. And obviously, I'm going to take Matt on faith for the first 20 minutes of Upstream Color. So all three of those movies, check them out. And Possessor, too.
Yes.
Good
four
stuff.
Four glowing recommendations today. Five if you count RoboCop.
Six if you count RoboCop. But in any case, I think that wraps up this episode. So until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Possessor Trailer No. 1, 2020, Movie Clips Trailers, uploaded by Movie Clips Trailers. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, January 24th, and we'll be discussing The Craft Legacy, a sequel/soft reboot of the 1996 film about a coven of high school witches.